Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. We're doing a live show today, and we're very lucky because our guest is Joan Nathan, an influential personality in the food world and author of the new cookbook, King Solomon's Table. First, a word from our sponsors. If you are looking for a little indulgence, check out Kerrygold Irish Cream Liqueur, a premium blend of natural cream, real chocolate, and aged Irish whiskey that was named the world's best cream liqueur at the 2016 World Drinks Awards. Enjoy Kerrygold over ice, in some coffee, or create your own specialty cocktail. Dave, you didn't put any Kerrygold in this latte you handed me, did you?
I can't say that on the air.
And also, Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school with locations around the globe, from Paris to London to Ottawa. The schools have a wide array of programs available, from nine-month classical culinary training programs all the way to bachelor and master's degrees. Or, how about one of their three-hour master classes on everything from baking the most delicious macaroons to making that perfect sauce? Visit cordonbleu.edu for more. And San Pellegrino is looking for the world's next great culinary talent. If that's you, be sure to enter the San Pellegrino Young Chef 2018 competition. Visit finedininglovers.com for the application and rules. Entries must be received by April 30th. That's coming up, folks. So if you're interested or know a great young chef, give them a little nudge. I would love for someone in the Bomb Squad to be named the San Pellegrino Young Chef 2018.
And I would love to have some Pellegrino here in the studio.
We can probably make that happen. We do have a refrigerator now. It's a little sad in the office. I mean, it's quirky. I won't say it's sad. It's quirky. And we have one of those little college dorm refrigerators.
Is it also a microwave?
I don't know. Maybe it spies on us. We'll have to check once the show's done.
I'll ask Kellyanne.
I am happy to report that it's been a good week for women in the food world. Right, Dave? We need to celebrate that from time to time.
Yeah, always.
The famous Union Square Hospitality Group, that's Danny Meyer's company, named its first female executive chef, Suzanne Cupps of Untitled at the Whitney Museum in New York. Congratulations to Suzanne. Be sure to visit Untitled if you're in New York and send your congratulations back to the kitchen. I feel like people don't send enough like nice love notes back to the kitchen. Also, and this is a biggie, Chef Barbara Lynch was named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people of 2017 in the whole world. Barbara's had some ride from an incredibly tough childhood to a leading light of Boston's culinary scene. If you want to know more about Barbara, she has a memoir that's out now. Be sure to pick it up.
She was on the front burner this morning.
Oh, she was?
Yeah.
Oh, and you can check that out. She also spoke at Jubilee, not once, but twice. You'll be able to hear that in a few weeks once we get all the Jubilee recordings loaded and locked and loaded. Right, Dave?
Yeah, something like that.
And Barbara was amazing. I mean, I think people were crying. She was crying. It got heavy. But she's amazing. So you'll want to check that out and check her book out, like I said. And speaking of leading lights, today's guest, Joan Nathan, is known as the Queen of American Jewish Cooking. Joan's latest book, King Solomon's Table, was published earlier this month, and it's a beautiful exploration of Jewish-influenced dishes from around the world. I didn't have a chance to check this with Joan. We started a little late today, so Joan, if any of this is incorrect, just interrupt me. For those of you who love cookbooks that you can cook from and curl up and read, not at the same time, obviously, King Solomon's Table is for you. We're going to talk about the growing popularity of Jewish cuisine, what foods are in the ultimate Joan Nathan pantry, and of course, how a king inspired this queen. Joan Nathan, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Well, it's so nice to be here, I must say. I love this place.
We are thrilled to have you here. Are you tired of hearing the queen? I'm clearly not the first who did the king and the queen thing.
No, actually, I hadn't heard that one before.
Oh, yay. Okay, that makes me happy. Because when you're on the book tour, you know, you...
Right, but I no one's put it together.
Excellent, excellent. I'm happy to be the first. How does it feel to be called the queen of something?
You know, a friend asked me that last night because I was speaking at Temple Emmanuel in New York, and the question was, how do you feel? Well, you know, I'm me. I mean, I am what I am, and I'm always thinking about new ideas and how food came to be, and, you know, how did Roberta's that I haven't been to in a long time get to be even more Roberta's?
That's a good way to put it. For those who haven't been here, you kind of have to come here to know what Joan is talking about. So how did you get christened the queen of American Jewish cooking?
I don't know. It's just been, people have called me the doyenne sometimes, and somebody must have written it in an article. I've been called the Indiana Joan of Jewish cooking.
Oh, the Indiana Jones. I like that. Okay, well, Indiana Joan.
That's right, Indiana Joan, but it was yes. Indiana Jones, but I thought Indiana Joan.
Exactly. I would have said doyenne, but I hadn't had coffee yet before I wrote the script, and sometimes that's a word that you can trip over. So you still have to answer, though, how did you get that title?
I have no idea. I think probably when Jewish Cooking in America came out, and it was, you know, very popular right away. So that got me the title.
Now, you've got 11 cookbooks. Where in your oeuvre does that fall?
You mean Jewish Cooking mm-hmm. in America? Mm-hmm. I guess. Well, it was the first one that I did with Judith Jones. So that was 1998.
Wow.
And it's probably about my fifth or sixth, maybe.
Since you mentioned Judith, we have to talk about her.
Okay.
I mean, what an incredible human being, and we just owe so much to her. I mean, Edna Lewis, Julia Child, you name it. What was your experience like working with her?
Well, it was really quite amazing. I worked with her for 4 cookbooks, and we became really good friends. I went up to her to Vermont to work on the books, and we would get, actually, I was just visiting her recently, and we were talking about how we would go down in the morning. We'd wake up, and she lives in this little house, looks a little bit like Roberta's, on a mountaintop in Vermont. And we'd go down to the pool. It wasn't a pool, but it was like a pond, a man-made pond. You'd walk down the hill from her house early in the morning, and we'd plunge into this ice-cold water, and we'd swim. And then we'd change and have a civilized breakfast. And of course, as all foodies, talk about what we were going to make for lunch. And where
you were eating breakfast.
Right. And we would where we were going to go visit in the afternoon. Of course, after spending hours working on the manuscript. But you had to break it up a little bit. And would we cook at night or would we go to a local restaurant? And
could I stop you there? I want to know what a typical Joan Nathan Judith Jones breakfast was post-plunge.
Post-plunge. Let's see. I can't I really should have taken many more notes. Sometimes it would be a croissant that she'd gotten. Sometimes she would make recipes for my books, like a scone or something else. Or sometimes it would be eggs, you know. She'd make an omelet and pluck some asparagus or something else from her garden, some herbs. She always was working in her garden. And, and then we'd have to go over the text that she would work on. And, of course, if she ever wrote, yes, she always used a green pencil, just nice, she'd say nice. That was, it made you feel so good that she said nice. You know, she was tough.
Was she? I was going to ask that.
Oh, well, with me, she was. And actually, when I first wrote the manuscript for Jewish Cooking in America, I remember exactly where I was. I was in my study in Washington. And my brother, I don't know why I remember that he was about to leave. And I get this phone call from Judith. There were was there a 1991 email? I have to see when. I think it might have been a little bit later.
There was primitive. I remember I was working at the Staten Island Advance, and we had like a primitive internal email system. So some people had it.
Anyway, so she said, I think you'll have to come to New York. I don't understand what you're doing. And I...
Ouch.
Right, exactly. Here I had sent in my manuscript, Ooh. And I was so afraid to talk to the great Judith Jones. And I thought, wait a minute, I know what's wrong with this manuscript. It was a cookbook, but I had done it in historical form rather than appetizers, breads, whatever. So I immediately realized how I would change it, And luckily, there was already the computer. So I was able to, you know, cut and paste. But I thought to myself, if it had been my first cookbook, I would have had to type the whole manuscript over.
Can you? Oh, my gosh. I hadn't thought about typewriter days in a long time.
But I did think about that then. I thought, oh, thank God there's a computer.
What else about Judith? I love that little, that she used a green pencil and would write.
Right. Well, she was
nice.
She is very, you know, unfortunately, she's not well. She was very gutsy, and a lot of people couldn't figure out our relationship, but I'm gutsy, and she wasn't afraid to do things. So once she came to Israel with me on a trip, and I remember walking around the old city, you know, and we both decided we wanted to go to visit a field near Bethlehem when it wasn't a good time to go to a field near Bethlehem, because she thought that somebody had told me that it was a field that was very similar to what it had been at the time of Jesus. So we took a taxi and we found this field, and then we came back and the Intifada started just that day. And I thought, wow, are we crazy? But we did it. And then she would go anywhere with me, and her stepdaughter Bronwyn was with us. We really had a great time, you know, visiting Arab and Jewish villages and going into homes. It was quite amazing.
And did home cooks make meals for you? Is that the point of going to the homes?
Well, that's the whole point of doing what I do. Mm-hmm. They always make meals for me, and that's what was fun. And I was able to show her so many of the things that I had learned from, you know, these people, and that was really fun.
So you called yourself gutsy. You just gave us a few examples of being gutsy
or crazy. Maybe gutsy or crazy.
But going into strangers' homes
and
asking them to cook for you, walking across that field at a time when it probably wasn't the best idea. And the post also, they called you a whirlwind. I was curious, what makes you a whirlwind?
I do a lot of things. I have a lot of energy.
You do?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
What's your secret?
Good genes,
yeah.
My mother just passed away at 103, and she was great that way.
I read about that. I'm sorry to hear that, that you lost her earlier this year. The Post also called her the Grand Dame of Providence, Rhode Island.
Well, she you know, because she would do whatever she wanted to. You know, everybody knew her.
What does that mean?
She'd say, well, she was a school teacher. Mm-hmm. So whenever anybody wrote something in Providence Journal, she would, if she didn't think it was correct English, she would call them. And for some reason, people listened to her. So she was gutsy, and she said what she wanted. She probably said what she wanted more than I do, but I'll probably grow into her.
Now, your mom's name was Pearl, right?
Yes.
What was Pearl like in the kitchen?
She didn't cook much. She did. When I was a kid, we had a cook. And, you know, some of my earliest memories of her snipping beans in the kitchen. And then my father lost a lot of money, so my mother started to cook. And she was good. Mm-hmm. And as she got older and older and older, she liked to cook. Her friends liked to clean up. So she would cook and they would clean. And she would much rather do that than go out to restaurants.
What happened that your dad lost a lot of money?
Well, he just made some bad business decisions. Yeah. And so she went. And then she went to teach. She mm-hmm. was she was the head of the English department, and she was a tough teacher, very tough. So she and Judith Jones had a lot in common. They were both tough on me.
So what was your mom cooking when she did start cooking?
Well, I guess one of our favorite dishes was her chicken cacciatore and her bread and butter pickles that she learned from one of the... during the Second World War, they had the army or the I don't know who put out recipes for bread and butter, things that you could make yourself. So she learned to make them before she never would admit that she really knew how to cook.
Was it part of the rationing that they were putting out recipes
that
you could make with?
What, with lentils and a lot of other things, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So how are the seeds planted for you to become who you became?
Well, my father was from Germany, and he was really interested in his own German food. So my aunt, Liesl, would be cooking German food every Friday for my father. And I would love to go over to her house. And, you know, I remember I tasted brains for the first time, and I thought it was delicious, with capers and lemon, so good. And, you know, she would get a lot of German food, sausages. And at Christmas time, she had a breezeway, and she would store all of her German Bavarian Christmas cookies, but she didn't make them red and green because we were Jewish. So she'd make them pink or she'd make them blue.
Oh, she was so chic and ahead of her time.
Right. And they were the best cookies. And just recently I learned, because my son is marrying a girl from Denmark, that these cookies were called, one of them with chopped nuts and egg yolk, they were called Jutekager, and they're Jewish cookies in Denmark for Christmas.
Oh, that's
so
amazing.
Yeah. So and that was one, and I realized this was exactly one of the versions of her cookies, so that these German Christmas cookies became Jewish cookies, but also called Jewish Christmas cookies in Denmark. So
they're called Jewish Christmas cookies.
Jewish cookies, Jewish cookies, but served for Christmas.
Oh, that's funny. We have to look those up. They sound great. All right, we are going to take a quick break, and we will be right back with Joe Nathan, and we're going to hear how King Solomon's Table came to be. Spoil yourself with Kerrygold Irish Cream Liqueur. This delicious grown-up treat is a perfectly balanced blend of three ingredients: natural Irish cream from grass-fed cows, velvety rich real chocolate, and whiskey that has been distilled and matured in Ireland for at least 3 years. Try it straight over ice, channel your inner mixologist and create your own specialty cocktail, or blend it with vanilla ice cream for the best adult milkshake you've ever had. Indulge in the smooth delight that is Kerrygold Irish Cream Liqueur. Le Cordon Bleu, the renowned culinary school, was founded in Paris 122 years ago by a young journalist named Mademoiselle de Stael. In 1895, she launched the first weekly culinary magazine called La Cuisinière Le Cordon Bleu. She invited subscribers to take part in free cooking lessons with the chefs featured in her magazine, and from there, the school was born. In the years since, Le Cordon Bleu's world-class instructors have taught French classical culinary techniques to everyone from home enthusiasts to food world legends. If you've ever dreamed of attending culinary school, maybe it's time to start living that dream. Check out one of Le Cordon Bleu's 35 locations around the world, or add a short vacation or weekend program at one of its schools to your next vacation. Visit cordonbleu.edu for course descriptions, dates, online registration, and to discover which school is best for you. It's all possible at Le Cordon Bleu. Hey, Bomb Squad. We're here with Joan Nathan, author of the new cookbook, King Solomon's Table. And Joan is going to tell us what the book's all about, how it came about, and how her book tour is going.
Well, the book is not what I started out to write. But when I went to India and I went to Kochi into a synagogue, and there was a sign that said Jews had been in Kochi in India since about the time of King Solomon, I thought, wow, that's about 1000 BC. And I started digging. And I realized that what's new is what's very old, like that we like chickpea pancakes, we like pomegranate paste, we like date jam, all tamarind, all these exotic ingredients were around at the time of King Solomon. And I just did a lot of research, and then I started thinking about how Jewish food had evolved. So I made sure that I had a really good introduction. And then I went around the world, as much then known world as what I could go to, and I learned so much more than I ever knew. about Jewish food. And so it came together as, and my editor loved, it was her idea to call it King Solomon's Table. And the reason that we used King Solomon was he was the first, we could have used King David, but King David was a warrior, you know, it was, King Solomon was wise. He had 700 wives. So think of all the spices and all the ingredients that he got from their tastes that came to him.
I did not know he had 700
300, wives. He had 300 concubines too.
Yikes.
But that was a sign of power in those times, you know, that the king, if you've ever been to a Buddhist temple, you'll see the place of the concubines at the feet of the king. So, and he also, in the Book of Kings, it says that he went out looking for spices and jewels. And I realized that this showed what Jewish food was all about. So for me, I realized that Jewish food, the dietary laws are so important, and the concept of the dietary laws and what Judaism is. And that's one main, and this table-centeredness, food-centeredness. Jews are food-obsessed, if you haven't noticed it. I mean, I know all New Yorkers are food-obsessed, but so that was the one component. The second was this merchant striving for what's new. And that's, you know, Jews have always been going out looking for things as they did at the time of King Solomon. And, you know, they went looking for, it says in the Book of Kings that they looked for peacocks and spices. So that, and it's continued. They're vintners and bakers and now look at all the restaurateurs that are Jewish. And now they're beginning to be a lot of Jewish chefs. So that's a component. The third component for me is the fact that Jews were kicked out of so many countries. So they had to adapt, but with the dietary laws. And even if they didn't believe in the dietary laws, it was in the back of their mind. They, as one person said to me, now we know in our DNA who's Jewish and who isn't. But then they knew who they were and what their religion was, and so that it showed itself in its food. And so as they would get kicked out, they'd have to adapt. And I went around the world. Like, I went to El Salvador, and I learned that they didn't have potato pancakes, which of course is something very new. And I was very aware of foods that came from the new world to the old world, and what the Jewish role was with these new foods. But when I went to El Salvador, I didn't have a potato pancake. I had a yuca pancake with cilantro cream. And I learned that Libyan food is going to be no more because there are no Libyan Jews. They're either in Israel or they're in Italy. So I had to grab what I could get when I could get it. And in El Salvador, there are 100 Jews. You know, so I went a lot of places, and I learned each time I learned something new. It was really quite fabulous.
So when did you decide that you didn't just want to celebrate food and recipes, but that you wanted to find the history behind recipes?
I've always felt that way. I wrote my first cookbook as a lark. It was called The Flavor of Jerusalem. I wrote it with somebody named Judy Stacy Goldman. We were working together. We were young. We were working for Mayor Teddy Kollek of Jerusalem. And I wanted to write about the people and food of Jerusalem. And our head notes were all about different traditions and different peoples. And it's always been something that and I guess it's from my background of my German background, and then my marrying my husband, whose mother was Polish, where I realized that food is a part of people. It's not just something you put on the table. And that's, you know, I love going to fancy restaurants, but that's not what really turns me on. It's people and connecting them. And it's fun. I've had a great run.
You absolutely have. Are you a good cook?
I like to think I am, but I'm, you know, I'm not. I look at chefs that are very precise. That's not the kind of cook I am. I'm cooking for people that need to get food on the table and that want it to make it like to look good. For example, my mother-in-law was, you know, she was a pretty good cook, but everything looked gray or white. Nothing had any color in it or any pick-me-up spice. And so I always feel that you first eat with your eyes. And, you know, and I show people when I do classes, an occasional class at my house, or I'm doing one at Macy's on Monday. I just show so simply how you can sprinkle something with parsley or dill or pomegranate seeds, arils. You know, it just makes a difference.
But you teach classes in your house in Joan Nathan's kitchen?
I do.
How does somebody get to do
just
that?
Just check out my website, joannathan.com.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah,
definitely.
I don't do it that often, but I do it a few times a year.
How did you wind up in D.C.?
My husband works at the worked at the Justice Department.
When did he finish?
He was there a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
And he went to private practice.
Oh, okay. He must be watching what's going on in D.C. with great interest.
Everybody is.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that there are more Jewish restaurateurs now and more Jewish chefs. I mean, there really has been this wonderful resurgence in Jewish food. How do you feel about what's going on?
Well, it's so interesting because, first of all, this new book of mine, I've never had a book that's had this reception. And I realize that Jewish food has gone above politics. People might not like a lot of things in Israel, but it's like a new food. And I can't tell you how many restaurateurs are happy that I'm going to Israel this summer because they want to find an Israeli chef who can make all these, the diaspora food. And I think it's fascinating. You know, it's like, it's the next one. I was at Shaya, which is an Israeli restaurant in New Orleans. And the Zulu King of Mardi Gras was there. And there were all these people that were clearly New Orleans. My daughter, who's worse than I am, I hope you're listening, Daniela. Both of my daughters are actually. Marissa, I hope you're listening. But I was with Daniela, and she went around asking all these people why they were at this restaurant. Because of the food. And we're just, everyone is, this is a great moment in American history for food and for, by the way, immigrants who really give us our food. And I think that's maybe why they're interested, another reason in this food, we're interested in the other, you know?
Talk about that more, how we're interested in the other.
Well, I realize, for example, that I have a cleaning woman from El Salvador, and I have taught her how to make my challah, how to make my brisket, and she's taught me how to make her yucca puffs, or yucca, I forget, yucca for yucca. And I love watching her make, what do they call the
arepas?
Right, well, that's one. Or, yeah, and I realized that two things. One, I totally trust her so that if I'm in a hurry, she'll make my dough. But what's so fascinating about working with her is that for her Christmas holidays or for Easter, she no longer makes pork. She now makes my brisket and that she probably gets from Costco, and she makes challah because she's learned that from me, and that's how foods travel. And I think that's beautiful, you know?
It absolutely is. So you're sort of I'm sure you've gotten credit for this, but you're kind of the godmother of this movement. You know, the fact that we're seeing all these beautiful dishes.
Oh, I like that.
Dishes.
I love it.
You are. You know, you had the Landmark Cookbook, and since then, I mean, Yotam Ottolenghi and Shaya, like you mentioned, and, look at the resurgence of Russ and Daughters with their cafe in the city, and Sidell's, and just, you know, so many examples.
Yeah, all over the country. I mean, I was just in Portland, and there's this little restaurant called Shalom Ya'al.
Is it Jewish and Southern?
Well, I don't know where the Southern came in, but it is Jewish. It's, you know, hummus. And I'm going to speak in Philadelphia today, and I understand that I'm not going this time, but I am in 2 weeks to Mike Solomonov, Solomonov's restaurant.
Right, forgot to mention him.
And he has now a whole block of restaurants.
It must make you so happy.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, it's fascinating.
So tell me about this dinner you have going on tomorrow back in D.C.
Oh, well, there's this restaurant called Buck's, and my same friend James Alefantes owns that restaurant, who owned owns Comet Pizza. So he had this idea of having all these Jewish chefs cook for my book and have a dinner, a Jewish dinner, and it's sold out.
I was just going to say, that's a hot ticket.
Yeah, and it'll be really fun. I mean, one of them is, well, actually, he's not a Jewish chef, Katsuya, I forget his last name, Yakumo, anyway, from Dakaya Izakaya. He's making matzo ball ramen. He's been writing to me all the time about matzo ball ramen. So I said, wouldn't you like to do that? So he's doing it. And I don't know what, I'm going to be surprised, I'm sure.
Oh, so they didn't, they so you don't know the menu, the
no.
whole, oh, that's fantastic.
And Amy Brandwine is doing it. She's a wonderful Italian. You should have her sometime on the show. She's
okay.
great from Centralina. She's one of these women who just for the, she's, first of all, she's very nice, but also for the love of it, she just will always volunteer to do, to help people, to make wonderful foods. And she's got, she's really a good cook.
Oh, we need to get to know her.
Yeah, she's very, it's her restaurant, Centralina. And it's real, it, actually, she's up for James Beard.
Oh, good for her.
Mid Atlantic.
Okay.
So keep your fingers crossed for her.
Okay. Are you on Instagram?
I am.
You are? Oh, good. What's your handle?
Oh, my gosh. I don't even know. I think it's _JoanNathan.
Okay. Okay. We will look that up. But take lots of pictures tomorrow so we can see.
Oh, okay.
So
I will.
We can follow along. And I imagine it'd be fun. Do you take a lot of pictures when you travel?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been doing that now, doing more than I usually do. And but Politics and Prose is co-sponsoring this dinner. And I know they will take a lot of pictures.
Okay. So we'll check out Politics and Prose, too. I mean, is it fair? Chefs hate that word fusion.
Right.
But looking through this cookbook, you can't help but be overwhelmed with the fusion aspect of it. Is that a word you like, or are you like chefs
yeah.
and you don't like that word?
No, I you know, what happens with Jewish food, sometimes it's side by side, you know? And like, I'll give you an example. There's a lot of intermarriage between, let's say, Moroccans and Algerians. And for the end of, for Passover, they have this wonderful soup that I wanted to put in this book, but I had it in another book, so I couldn't put it. But it's a spring soup that the Tunisian Jews always have. And it's got artichoke in it and all kinds of spring vegetables. So this, actually, it's Tunisian. This Tunisian woman wanted to make that for her soup, but her Moroccan husband wanted his spring soup. So instead of combining them to one soup, they're side by side. And that often happens. And then the other thing that happens are in my Passover Seder, when we find a really good recipe, like the in my new book, the eggs with served with spinach, the eggs that are cooked for hours and hours. And one of the first foods that you eat at a Passover Seder, or many, I think mostly Polish Jews do, is eggs in like a saltwater soup. So that everybody, that's what we always had at our Seder, but everybody loved this other dish so much that this year, it was the first year I did not have a Seder, but my daughter did in L.A., she assigned me to make that dish because it's so good. So a better food will replace it. So if Jews are, let's say, an Ashkenazi and a Sephardic get married, most often the Sephardic food, because that's the kind of food we eat today, with less fat, that's more vegetable-oriented, that will replace the Ashkenazic food. And it's certainly like in France, where 70% or even more of the French Jews today are from North Africa, the North African food has obliterated the Ashkenazi food. I was at a wedding in Paris a few years ago from somebody from a very old Alsatian family, and there were fancy people like Christian Boutin was there, and a lot of the French actors. And he married a Tunisian girl. And at the Friday night dinner, there was all this Tunisian food and one plate of gefilte fish that her father, who was Polish, had made, and one other thing that was Polish Jewish. Everything else was Tunisian, And I think that's because that's what people want to eat. And nobody ate the gefilte fish. But gefilte fish can be really good.
Probably not the most popular wedding food, I'm guessing.
Right.
But your book really celebrates all of this and more. Like I said, it's such a wonderful read. I mean, it's definitely one of those cookbooks that you you won't just cook from this cookbook. You will definitely want to sit down and spend some time, you know, just learning the history behind these dishes and just understanding a little bit more about what Joan does and why. We are going to take one more break, and when we come back, we're going to ask Joan to tell us what is in the ultimate Joan Nathan pantry. Mm. Do you know a great young chef? Then make sure she or he enters the San Pellegrino Young Chef 2018 competition. San Pellegrino is extending this opportunity to chefs under the age of 30 with at least 1 year's experience in a restaurant. 10 semifinalists will be chosen to compete for a spot to represent the United States at the grand finale in Milan. All entrants must apply by April 30th, so don't delay. Visit finedininglovers.com for the application and rules. The world's next great culinary talent just might be you. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. We're here with Joan Nathan. And as promised, Joan, I'm really curious about what's in the ultimate Joan Nathan pantry.
Well, first of all, the pantry is the first chapter of my book. And I did that because I realized people might want to know what I use. And the most important thing for me is preserved lemons. And whatever you buy at the supermarket is not as good as what I make in my kitchen.
But sometimes you need them and you didn't make them in time. You can't. Well, it's not like you can make them overnight.
So what people should do is, whoever listens to this should go home, go to wherever you can get a bunch of lemons. You cut them down, cut them in four, not through to the end, lengthwise. And then you put like a tablespoon of salt on each side and put them in lemon juice and leave them for a while. I sometimes put fresh bay leaves in. It's really pretty. Some people put garlic in. I don't. I just put lemon juice in. And it's the recipe is in my book. But that's the most important thing in my
so that's
pantry.
That's a quickie preserved lemon recipe?
Very, very easy. And one thing you can do, but I don't do, you can freeze your lemons first, and that will soften the rind and so that it will preserve quicker. But, you know, I kind of like slow. And so I make them several times a year. And I use them all the time.
I'm sure you get hit up for auction stuff all the time. I would pay top dollar for Joan Nathan's preserved lemons.
Oh, well.
That should be your auction thing from now on.
Okay, I'll do that. You're right. And then what I do is I always make my own cumin. It's cumin turmeric salt. And in the morning when I want to save calories but have protein, I'll have a hard-boiled egg and I'll dip it in that salt. So I have that for myself. And then I make harissa from, you know, red peppers. And I also make tzhug from green peppers. So those are three things. Oh, and then I also have apricot jam, but thick apricot jam from Leathers that I use for stuffing good pastries.
So wait, when you say from Leathers, from the dried fruit?
Yeah.
And you make that from scratch?
Well, I don't dry the fruit.
Okay.
I mean, I use them.
But you make the jam from scratch with the dried apricots.
Yeah,
wow.
And that's good for preserving. And the thing is, and I also, I'll tell you what else. In a way, my refrigerator is my pantry. I once a week will make a vinaigrette, a good vinaigrette. And that way it makes it easy for me to make salads every day. And I have never yet liked a bottled vinegar.
What's a classic vinaigrette in your repertoire?
Well, I learned to make it many, many years ago from French cousins. I have a lot of European cousins in France. And it's just with shallots and garlic and actually wine vinegar. Or balsamic, a little bit of honey if I don't use balsamic, or a little sugar, salt, pepper, I forget what else, and olive oil, of course. And what I do is pretty much half and half.
Half vinegar, half oil.
Yeah, instead of
that's
less.
That's strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's not that strong, but it's good.
That's how you like it.
Yeah.
Any store-bought pantry essentials?
should I admit this?
Sure.
I use Pam because it's so easy for you. It's the only thing. And when I do these videos, I don't know why I'm telling you this. When I do these videos for Tablet Magazine, I will rub like olive oil on a cookie pan or something like that rather than spraying. But I always spray. It's so much easier. So that, you know, or use butter.
We're getting all Joan Nathan secrets here today.
Oh, and you know
today.
What else? Something else that's new. You can get this from King Arthur's. They have cut parchment paper, like 100 of them, so that I use them on my cookie sheets and rounds. So you can get this. They're fabulous.
Oh, that's
so
handy.
Easy. It's really handy.
Because I can't, anytime I have to cut around parchment paper, it looks like a crazy person.
Right,
did it,
exactly.
Or a child was attempting to do a snowflake or something.
See,
never looks good.
Absolutely, and that's when I think, oh, I'm not like the other, you know, food writers or chefs. Of course, nobody talks about food writers anymore. It's only chefs. But they're always so precise, and I'm not precise in cutting. So,
you had mentioned earlier that you can tell a lot about a person by what's in their fridge. What can we tell? If we were to open your fridge right now,
well,
aside
right,
from the fact that you're not home, right. What could we tell about you?
Well, you'd see a lot of ingredients that are in there that were used for one thing and that I can't bear to throw away. So when my kids come home, or my assistants who are, you know, young too, they'll look at it and they'll throw it out. And actually, Judith Jones and I have that in common, and Julia Child, because you can't bear to throw things out. Of course, you never use them. So, and you know, I'll get rid of them every once in a while. But there's things that I've had for a long time.
What's the oldest condiment in your fridge?
I realize, what's it called? You know, the Korean kimchi.
Mm-hmm.
When Charles Fan, from the slanted
sure.
door, he's a good friend of mine. He went looking for a lot of kimchi. And a few years ago, and I realized about 2 weeks ago that I still had that kimchi. And then, of course, I'm sure it lasts forever, but I got rid of it.
So we have a few more minutes with you. Where do you stand on hummus?
Oh, well, I love my hummus. And I know Mike Solomonov has great hummus and everybody else, but this is what my latest, you know, I'm always changing. First of all, I put preserved lemon in my hummus.
Mm.
And the second thing I do is I put cumin in. I cook the chickpeas for a long time, but I don't peel them. What I do is I put them in the food processor for a very long time. So they're really, really smooth. And the longer you do that, the smoother they get. And I always save the water from cooking the chickpeas. And then because it hardens up, and then I keep it and then add some more. You know, I sometimes will take it out of the refrigerator, and it might be very thick. So what I do is I puree it a little bit more with some of that liquid, and it's wonderful.
When you say long, how long is long in the food processor?
Well, a few minutes until it's soft, until you see that it's really soft, because that's what you want.
The last time I made hummus, I peeled the skin off each chickpea. And it was kind of therapeutic, you know, in a way, and meditative, but it's a lot of work.
It's a lot. I mean, I know that, I think Ruth Reichel does that, and I told her I just didn't bother. And so what I do, if you'll see, if you really, and a lot of people have legions of help, right, that they can do that. I don't. And I don't think most
Who
people
has legions
do.
Of help?
Right.
Except in restaurants, maybe.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, but if you do that, it really, really makes it soft.
So, Joan, I hate to end today's show. It's been wonderful.
It's been fun. I'll have
having
to come
you
back.
On. Absolutely. Anytime. Absolutely.
Okay.
And we'll come visit you in D.C. too. There's a really wonderful group of women in hospitality in D.C. called Pineapple D.C.
I'm speaking there.
You are? Oh, fantastic. When?
June 1st, I think.
Oh, great.
They've been wanting me to do it since the book came out. And they're big on Cherry Bomb.
We love them, and that's fantastic that you'll be speaking. So June 1st?
June 1st.
And the information's probably on the Pineapple D.C. website.
I hope so.
Should check it out if you're in the area. So that's it for today's show. Radio Cherry Bomb was engineered by the one and only Dave Tatasciore. Thank you, Dave. Thank you to our sponsors for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. Be sure to have Kerrygold Irish Cream Liqueur on hand for all your entertaining needs. Visit cordonbleu.edu to learn about the variety of culinary classes offered at the legendary Le Cordon Bleu's many locations around the world. Don't forget the application period for the San Pellegrino Young Chef 2018 competition is now open. Visit finedininglovers.com to apply, and be sure to enter by April 30th. And lastly, I think I forgot to mention this earlier, we are giving away a signed copy of Joan's new cookbook, King Solomon's Table. You can leave a comment on our Instagram account, at Cherry Bomb Mag, for a chance to win. So much winning, everybody. Thank you for listening. You're the bomb.
Hi, I'm Hetty McKinnon, and I'm the founder of Arthur Street Kitchen, where I make salads for my community. I'm also the author of two salad cookbooks, the latest of which is called Neighborhood and will be released in America on the 27th of June, ready for a summer of salads. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or to learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Vegan chef Daphne Chang, because of her commitment to bringing a plant-based food revolution to China. I have no doubts she will succeed.